Stand rock solid, oh you lovers, stand with me. Rise in spirit, oh you lovers, rise in me. Sing together, oh you lovers, sing with me.
Hello, this is T. Thorne Coyle. Welcome to Elemental Castings, my bi-monthly podcast on the tour through all things sacred, mystical, magical, and esoteric. Let us take a breath together as we call in the elements of life, air, fire, water, earth, and ether, and say, Holy Mother, in whom we live, move, and have our being, from you all things emerge, and unto you all things return. Today's podcast, we're focusing on the element of earth, the powers of the land, the powers of silence, the powers of geometry, the powers of the body, and the powers of all form made manifest. Our guest today is John Michael Greer, who is a prolific author of books on nature spirituality, magical traditions, and the future of industrial society, with 20 published books to his credit, as well as the widely cited blog The Archdruid Report. Since 2003, he has also been the Grand Archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America, a contemporary druid order founded in 1912. He lives in southern Oregon. And you can reach him and his blog through thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com. And as usual, I am at thorncoyle.com. Welcome, John Michael. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
So I want to start off, I want to talk to you a little bit today about geomancy, but I would like to start off by asking you, what drew you to druidry in particular? I know you've studied a lot of magical systems and are not just a druid, but I'm curious about what drew you into the Order of Druids.
Well, basically, I started out back in my teenage years as a student of the Golden Dawn system of magic. That was, if there is such a thing as chance, a point that I tend to doubt, it was simply chance that I happened to find that when I first went looking for something that went a little deeper than the very boring version of reality that my teachers and the media and everyone else insisted was all that was out there. And I happened to come across a book on Golden Dawn magic. It was actually Francis King and Stephen Skinner's Techniques of High Magic. I'm not sure I'd recommend it as a first book at this point, but I thought when I found it, I thought I'd found the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent about 20 years doing mostly Golden Dawn stuff, and then gradually started expanding, getting further and further into the philosophical bases of magic, into the various historical and spiritual traditions out of which the Golden Dawn tradition came. At the same time, I was finding one major factor lacking in the Golden Dawn system, which was a lack of any connection to nature, to the
right.
Earth. And that's always been very important to me spiritually. If I have a definition of God, it's nature.
Mm-hmm.
When I have spiritual experiences, they involve nature pretty much across the board. That's where the divine is for me. And so it was probably inevitable I would find my way into some form of nature spirituality. It happened to be, again, by chance, if such an improbable thing exists, that some people that I knew by way of a magical lodge that I belonged to were also involved in one of the contemporary druid orders, the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids,
mm-hmm.
and suggested that maybe I might want to check out what they had to offer. Famous last words, I got
right.
involved in that organization, did their complete training program, which is very demanding and very, very useful, and then kind of proceeded from there.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up set out to try to contact this old-fashioned druid order that I'd read about in a book, the Ancient Order of Druids in America. The author of the book did not like them much, thought they were boring and old-fashioned, one of these sort of stuffy old lodge things. So I knew I'd love it, of course. And it took me like 2 years to actually make contact with them because the addresses that I had were no longer valid. And we proceeded to have a series of conversations where I started saying, I'd like to learn more about the AODA. It sounds kind of interesting. and proceeded through, wow, this is really cool. Have you considered blowing the dust off of this and getting into the hands of more than the half dozen people who are doing things with it nowadays? And then ended up with me going, you want me to run it? Basically, I was 30 years younger than anybody else in the order.
Right.
And I was the first person who had really expressed any significant interest in it for rather a few years. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of decided that since I had a background in druidry and a background in magic, and I knew one of the remaining movers and shakers through the American Tarot Association and so on, they decided I was about, if they had a chance, if the organization was going to survive, I was probably going to be the one to make that happen.
Right.
So I ended up as an archdruid.
That's incredible. So it's funny to me, this combination, of course, of Golden Dawn and druidry, which seems to suit you very well.
Thank you.
It suits your temperament and what I know of you. But of course, Golden Dawn, as you've mentioned, is typically air, and druidry is typically earth.
Well, that's...
Maybe stereotypically.
Maybe stereotypical. Golden Dawn is, the Golden Dawn tradition is very intellectual. On the other hand, it has more clutter, pound for pound, than any other Western magical tradition out
there.
Well,
this is true. They like their stuff.
They like their stuff. You've got that earth, that sort of Victorian gingerbread, claptrap consciousness, like an old Victorian mansion, or the sort of knick-knack shelves you find your grandma's house with all the little figurines in it. The Golden Dawn's full of that kind of stuff. And there's also a very intellectual dimension, a very air dimension to the Druid tradition as we now have it. There's a lot of sacred geometry. There's a lot of sometimes very abstruse philosophy, and a peculiar sense of humor that seems to be pervasive in the Druid community, a tendency to the absolute deadpan put on, which I find immensely appealing.
I have a little bit of that in myself, which often just confuses people.
Oh, it does. It does.
I occasionally have to say, I was joking.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the Druids is they don't always say that.
Right.
William Stukeley, who was a very influential 18th century figure, one of the founders of the Druid Revival, he wrote a book on Stonehenge that was one of the first really useful scientific studies of it. He did a really detailed examination of the layout of the stones and this kind of stuff, what kind of the foundations of modern Stonehenge archaeology. And he inserted in this book a chapter claiming that Stonehenge had been built by a band of intelligent elephants who came up from Africa for the purpose.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, what he did actually was at that time it was very déclassé to suggest that the Stonehenge could have been built by the ancient Britons. It had to be someone else. We knew they were all savages, died in woad, and couldn't have put up something as grand as Stonehenge. So there was this huge flurry of theories. It was made by the Phoenicians, or it was made by the Romans, or it was made by the Egyptians, or it was made by, you name it, it was made by somebody other than the ancient Britons. So Stukeley took all of the arguments that had been used for these other things and applied it to his elephants.
Right.
And the entire chapter is raucous satire, but it's absolutely deadpan.
Right.
To this day, writers about Stukeley's work are going, what did he mean by going on about this elephant? But you go to Stonehenge and before dawn someday, listen in the silence. You'll hear Stukeley's voice still laughing.
So, speaking of Stonehenge, and you mentioned sacred geometry, of which Stonehenge is a beautiful example, was it your studies in druidry that caused you to begin studying geomancy?
Actually, no. It was the Golden Dawn.
Uh-huh.
One of the very few places that the geomancy survived was in the Golden Dawn, where it was one of the three systems of divination that the original Golden Dawn members were expected to study.
That is something I didn't know.
Yeah. It's now I have to say that what the Golden Dawn communicated about geomancy was, well, fragmentary is a gentle way of putting it. Apparently MacGregor Mathers, one of the two main founders of the Golden Dawn, went to the British Library and took a book of some 600 pages, John Hayden's book on geomancy, and put together a 24-page resume of some of the high points. Mm-hmm. And that was the Golden Dawn Knowledge Lecture on Geomancy.
Oh, right.
And as you can imagine, you take 600 pages of anything and boil it down to 24 pages, and what you've got leaves out a little bit.
Yeah.
But for more than a century, that was what you could get mm-hmm. on geomancy. Mm-hmm. And all of the books, the handful of books, there are not many of them, that were written about geomancy up until very recently, were based entirely on that 24-page, very simplistic, you cast a chart and then look up an answer on a table.
Mm-hmm.
And the answers were not very useful.
Mm-hmm.
You would do this entire exceptionally ornate, complex process and end up with evil except for bloodletting. Now, this is very helpful, I'm sure, if you were considering bloodletting, but other than that, I don't know.
So, explain to us briefly what geomancy is.
It's a system of divination based on binary numbers, mm-hmm. like the I Ching.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably most of our listeners are familiar with the old Chinese Book of Changes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our computer-obsessed age, I think most of us know about binary numbers 10, 1010, 1011,
right.
and this kind of stuff. The hexagrams of the I Ching are six-digit binary numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Geomancy uses four-digit binary numbers. And instead of doing solid lines and broken lines, it does one dots or two dots.
Mm-hmm.
So you have four of those, one or the other, forming a four-digit number. There are the 16 geometric figures. And you can generate them using basically anything from a tossed coin on up and whatever level of complexity you want to generate those initial yes, no, on, off, one, zero, one dot, two dot. And so you get your 16, you originally cast four of those figures, and then you combine them in various ways to produce a chart that looks rather a lot like a medieval astrological chart, which
mm-hmm.
you then interpret.
Mm-hmm.
It is mathematically very simple. If you can add up to 2 plus 2 and tell the difference between an odd number and an even number, you can cast a geometric chart. And it's actually an extremely flexible system. It has a lot of relationship to astronomy, but some of the old Renaissance authors called it astronomy's daughter. I think of it instead as astrology's bratty kid sister.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what is the relationship, if any, to sacred geometry?
There is probably one back somewhere. We're getting into complex territory here because the sacred geometry that we now have is a fragment of one quarter of the old fourfold Pythagorean science of number,
mm-hmm.
the quadrivium, as it was called back
mm-hmm.
in the days, the four ways. There was arithmology.
Right.
We say numerology nowadays, but I try to avoid that because most people think that means adding up the letters of your name to
right.
this fortune-telling method. This is the magical science of number. Arithmology. You have sacred geometry. You have harmonics,
mm-hmm.
which includes music, proportion, any form of numerical relationship. And you have, they would have said astronomy, by which they meant astrology,
right.
by which they meant calendrics, the study of calendars,
mm-hmm.
and everything having to do with time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have number in itself, you have number in space, you have number in time, and you have number in space and time.
Right.
Geomancy, if it connects to any of these, and to some extent a strong case can be made that it does, actually relates not so much to sacred geometry, but to arithmology, to the study of number in and of itself, because it's all about ones and twos.
Mm-hmm.
And it ties back into the old Pythagorean theories about one being manifestation, being limit, and two being the limitless, the unmanifest, the chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
The vague and undetectable, and so there's a bunch of stuff that ties into that, but it's a lot of the old connections we simply don't have them anymore.
Right.
I mean, so much of what we have in terms of the old magical traditions are broken fragments
mm-hmm.
of a machine that once made sense. We're
mm-hmm.
still very much trying to put it back together again.
This is all really intriguing to me, and I'm wondering. If you find, as so many of us do, that things are getting rebuilt now, not always through pagan means, but through scientific means, that some of these old sciences are having to be recaptured now via contemporary methods. For example, just all of our magical not obsession, our magical preoccupation with proportion, with drawing the pentagram precisely, with calling things in through proportion and through harmonics, whether we know it or not. Harmonics, of course, is embedded into our ritual practices. And so we have this unfolding. Simultaneously, we see the mathematical equations of all this, of course, through things like the golden mean, which, of course, there's been a renaissance in the usage of that, not just through math majors. And then it seems to me that this has also been unlocked through contemporary astronomy, some of the branches of contemporary physics, that sort of thing. And so all of this that would have been under the rubric of the old philosopher magicians, like Pythagoras, has now been split into magic workers, mathematicians, and scientists.
Well, the way I like to think of it, do you remember the myth of Osiris?
Yes.
When he was captured, when the second time he died, the evil god Set discovered him and had him hacked into pieces.
Right.
The pieces were flung all across Egypt, up and down one side or the other. Magic is Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
And the body of Osiris, the body of magic, has been hacked to pieces, and all sciences, all crafts, all arts, all spiritualities are chunks, gobbets,
right,
of the body of Osiris, the body of the great art.
Right.
And the one problem with this is that, you know, random chunks of a body don't live.
Right.
And so I see part of the work of our time is beginning the process. It's going to be a very, very long process, but beginning the process of doing what Isis did and going and ranging up and down the Nile and finding pieces. You know, okay, here's his left big toe.
Right, remembering.
Remembering, literally, putting the great art back together again. You're certainly right that some of this material, some of the numerical material, has been showing up in astronomy, in certain branches of physics, in a variety of places. And generally, the astronomers and the physicists and the mathematicians and so on are basically being dragged, kicking and screaming in the direction of the old unitary science.
Right.
They don't like it at all.
No, they don't. And particularly not because our contemporary culture has gone so far into dismemberment that everyone's a specialist.
Everyone's a specialist.
No one wants to look at the unitary nature.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do look at the unitary nature of things, the limitless nature of things, you're considered to be fringe, if not a crackpot.
You're a wacko.
Right.
You're obviously a wacko. We all know that, you know, the laws that govern living things have nothing to do with the laws that govern physics, with the laws that govern the mind, blah, blah, blah. You fill in the blank. Because our worldview is a worldview of dismemberment.
Yeah.
Our culture sought freedom by tearing the world apart.
Right.
You know, the idea was that if we opened up empty space in our world, and the only way to do that is to hack it to pieces and push the pieces out as far as we can. I'm convinced that 1,000 years from now, people will think about the whole superstition of the Big Bang and the expanding universe as this amazing mythology that the ancient Americans, the ancient industrial peoples came up with as a way of you know, projecting their fantasies of a dismembered universe onto the cosmos.
That's really interesting. So, what is your sense of origin, if you have any sense of origin?
I'm not sure.
Since you're talking about the Big Bang, which I also think is a nice theory and a good myth as any.
It's a remapping of the Christian creation myth into the usual secular lines, just as the myth of progress is the Christian myth of redemption in Frustum and secular drag. You sometimes get some absurdly exact versions of that, as in the Exotropians, who basically have the rapture mythology of modern fundamentalist Christianity, except they expect machines to do it in place of angels. I don't believe there was an origin. I don't believe there was an end. I don't see any need for that. You know, the universe is a, if there was, how would we know?
Right.
In either way. Certainly for all human purposes, the world came into being.
Mm-hmm.
The world that we, this planet, you know, the Earth, our mother, came into being at a certain point. She was born and she will die. We each were born. We each will die. The universe, is it possible even to think about that in a rational sense? I'm not convinced of that.
Well, one thing that helps me in my theology is everything around me and inside of me is in process.
Mm-hmm.
All of nature is in process.
Mm-hmm.
The cosmos is in process.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to extrapolate from that that what I call God herself is in process,
mm-hmm.
you know. And another thing I like that points to your saying that there's not necessarily origin or end, in a more recent translation of Genesis by the Jewish Publication Society, their opening is a beautiful sentence. It opens with, "When God began to create." It doesn't say in the beginning.
I mean, when God began to create.
So that means that
there
was existence before mm-hmm. the act of creation of mm-hmm. this planet.
It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alfred North Whitehead, a philosopher of several, a couple of generations back, actually worked out a very detailed, what he called process theology,
mm-hmm.
in which the divine is itself evolving and changing
right.
over time. So, you know, it's something that I think the modern pagan and magical community could well look into and, you know, do some thinking. We need a little more depth.
I agree.
I mean, we've got a lot of passion. We've got a lot of technique. We've got a lot of enthusiasm, but we could speaks the Sun in Gemini, Druid. We could use a little more intellectual depth and a little more richness. And there are plenty of traditions in philosophy, plenty of traditions even in theology that could very easily be borrowed and used as starting points, as
mm-hmm.
springboards
mm-hmm.
for our own theological reflection as pagans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just like to see an increase in critical thinking, because so much of our...
You don't want much, do you?
I know. I'm a dreamer. But I actually think it's happening more and more, and I think people are interested in theology that actually can make sense rather than strictly be fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
And with an increase in critical thinking skills, we can say, oh, well, we say we believe this, but what is truly our experience?
Mm-hmm.
And how do these things connect or not connect to each other?
Yeah.
And what's the natural flow intellectually from these? And are there any conclusions to be drawn or not?
Yeah. Do the things we say we believe actually work out in our beliefs?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Because we say we believe a lot of things that
mm-hmm.
our very actions give lie to. And I would love to see more of a shift from that into serious theology.
It would be welcome.
Yeah.
It would be welcome. The one thing that I would say, though, is that it's important to remember that what's fantastical now was not necessarily fantastical 100 years ago or 500 years ago. Each age, each period in history has its own definitions of what's real and what's fantastical.
Right.
And we are in the... Well, it takes a certain number of generations for a given set of insights into the world
mm-hmm.
to really start resonating. And you get a lot of sort of simplistic versions of it early on. I
mm-hmm.
think of the way that Newtonian cosmology gave rise to a sort of early, medieval cosmology light, but mm-hmm. with more space.
Mm-hmm.
And then very gradually the implications started sinking in, and you ended up with that permeating throughout the Western world, and you had the emergence of representative government, the idea that the individual, like a Newtonian planet, you know, you have all, instead of having one system in which everyone and everything is embedded
mm-hmm.
in a given place, even rank in the hierarchy, you know, here's the Earth and here's the sphere of the moon and a place for everyone and everyone in their place. We end up with this sort of idea, this Newtonian political space in which every human planet follows its own orbit.
Right.
Governed only by a common law. We have not yet absorbed the impact of Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
We have not yet absorbed the impact of the emergence of ecology as a science.
Right.
And it strikes me that that will have revolutionary impacts as it begins to really shape what's going on in our minds, in our cultures, in our behavior. To some extent, the rise of paganism is part of that, because so much paganism is so centered on nature.
I agree. I agree with that. It'll be really interesting to see what happens over the next 20, 30 years even, let alone 100 years from now.
Well, we're in a fascinating situation because all of us who were around in 1989, 1990, 1991 got to see how totalitarian Marxian socialism fell, failed the reality test, bam, it's gone. Now capitalism's doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
You know, so the two great rivals of the Cold War, both of them prove catastrophically failure-prone. What's next?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to recalibrate our entire way of thinking about the range of possibilities open to us in the economic sphere and in the social sphere.
So let me ask you a question. Do you think we're also going to have to reframe our thinking out of sheer necessity because we are in a food crisis of our own making, particularly in places like the U.S. where monoculture, both our overculture that humans live in has turned into a monoculture, and agriculturally we have monoculture, which has just been devastating. And, you know, the Colorado River no longer reaches the sea, all of those other things, because, you know, suburbs in Arizona need more golf courses. And I'm seeing that the children and their children that are, you know, children now and their children that are to follow are going to have a radically different way of thinking, because the world they live in is likely going to look different. And how they relate to food is likely going to look different than the way we related to food in the late 20th and early 21st centuries.
Yes. And I mean, there's a whole range of things going on here. On the one hand, there's the just idiotic policies that we as a society have taken toward the natural systems that sustain all our lives. There's also the fact that we have, since World War II, people in the United States have gotten used to an international order that enables the 5% of us who live in this country to use roughly a third of the world's resources and industrial products.
Right.
Okay. People tend to bristle a little bit when you mention American empire, but you know, we have troops in 140 countries, and we don't send them there for their health.
Right.
That's breaking down. We ended up taking over the British Empire's place when the British Empire went down in the aftermath of World War I. Okay. Now it's our turn. Empires don't last long. It's not an arrangement with a long lifespan.
Right.
As that happens, we're going to have to get used to living on something much closer to what we produce ourselves, and that amounts to everybody in this country taking an 80% pay cut. Okay, we're going to we're going to be facing more change in the next 20, 30, 40 years than I think most people are capable of imagining. And it won't be apocalyptic. It's not going to be, you know, we wake up tomorrow, we're living in caves.
Right.
That fantasy is part of the way that we evade the humdrum everyday reality of a contracting economy and a declining society.
So I've been thinking and talking lately about tribalism and how tribalism has really good qualities, and tribalism has really heinous, hideous qualities. And pagans are very fond of tribalism.
Well, on paper.
You know, but I'm seeing it more and more where certain groups are trying to lock down their borders, certain pagan groups, and say, no, we need to preserve what we have, not be so open, even though the need is increasing. That sort of thing is happening. And hearing you talk about having to shift the way we think and act and deal with life on a day-to-day basis because of the contracting economy makes me think, well, one thing that we are likely going to have to learn again is communalism and true sharing, which is a tribal value, yet without the xenophobic tribal problem. you know, that comes along with it. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that for our immediate future.
Very much so. Instead of tribe, I'd like to suggest the word neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago, and you still get this in some cities, especially out east,
mm-hmm.
You have individual neighborhoods with their own character, their own culture, often their own ethnic mix, and their own local institutions, their own voluntary institutions, their own civil society. That's what we need to rebuild more than anything else. I know it's not going to happen, but I would love to be able to see a situation where some significant number of pagans were to make up their mind to move into one of these half-empty cities,
mm-hmm.
of which there are quite a few now, move into them and establish neighborhoods there,
mm-hmm.
get together, develop the small local businesses, develop, you know, develop the community, develop the institutions, and actually see what happens when we take the values that we affirm on paper and actually put them into practice on a daily basis.
I'm seeing pockets of that when I travel. I was just in Baltimore, and I stayed, you know, that's a city that's halfway boarded up and has been for a long time. And I stayed at the Red Clover Collective, who own a big, beautiful building. Half of it's a house and then four apartments. And so they're doing a communal living experiment in a house that would normally be out of reach in any other sort of urban neighborhood. And what they're doing to help the neighborhood is their mandate is to teach people container gardening to increase self-sufficiency in the neighborhood. Because you see, in Baltimore, you cannot grow food in the ground because the lead content is so high.
Okay.
Everything is toxic. Their soil cannot cross state lines. And
is that an industrial thing?
You know, I'm not sure. It must be a combination of things, because it was an old industrial town, and it was, of course, a shipping port. But my friend with whom I was staying said, oh, yeah, when we do soil rehabilitation with sunflowers, because they extract the toxins from the ground, we have to take the sunflowers to the toxic waste dump. But I just love that there is this anarcho-pagan collective in Baltimore teaching container gardening, you know, and it's things like that that give me hope.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that we need to see happening. I would like to, I really think the time may be approaching where partly, I mean, we have this fantasy that the pagan community, paganism is this rural thing.
Which is just ridiculous.
Which most pagans are city kids.
Or suburban.
Or, oh God.
Actually.
Yes, I tremble at the thought. I grew up in a suburb. I will never live in a suburb.
Mm-hmm.
Has all the disadvantages of the countryside and the city and none of the advantages of either.
Right.
But that's me being grumpy about my origins. So.
Well, they also killed America.
Well, yes, among other things. And they have, as Jim Kunstler points out, it's a lifestyle without a future.
Yes.
It depends on the capacity to waste fantastic amounts of energy, you know, driving 2 miles to the grocery store.
Right.
And it's going away. Deal with it.
It's also the cause of a lot of our isolationism.
Very much so. Very much so. So, but I would like to, I'm very much starting to think in terms of, let's start looking at what we can offer to communities,
as what
pagans can offer to some of these communities that are, for example, desperately trying to get artists and writers and things like that to move in.
Right.
And spruce up beat up old neighborhoods and turn them into happening areas.
Right.
I could see a mob of pagans showing up in such a place and turning into a very happening neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
it's one of the things we're hoping to do with our Solar Cross project.
Well, excellent.
Is to create urban space rather than, you know, every pagan group wants to buy land.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think you're right that we need to start focusing on the urban spaces. For one thing, they're just more sustainable.
Yes.
And for another thing, if we all move to the wild, there will be no wild left.
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
What I'd like to see instead is to look at greening the city.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I'm not necessarily talking huge cities here. There are some relatively small cities out there, cities of 20, 30, 50,000 people, which is not exactly big, that are, you know, that have a lot of empty buildings, that are looking for people to move in, that are, that, you know, So, but at any rate, you know, those who want a really big city, there's some of those available too.
Mm-hmm.
But just look at taking neighborhoods and greening them, getting the trees growing, getting the container gardens and the rooftop gardens going, getting the insulation in, getting the low energy systems where wind and sun are available, putting those to work. There's a huge amount that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And to imagine a neighborhood as it could be 10 years from now that is basically a pedestrian neighborhood because nobody bothers with the car.
Right.
That, you know, where there's solar hot water heaters on every roof,
mm-hmm.
and container gardens on the roofs, and every vacant lot is full of trees.
Right.
And, you know, all the little along the sidewalks, you got the row of trees, which in 50 years are going to be towering and beautiful and just now, you know, are flowering signs of hope. And you've got the bookstores, and you've got the cafes, and you've got the bars, and you've got the entertainment venues and the musical places and all this sort of stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of things that make for great neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And not great suburban neighborhoods, great compact neighborhoods. So instead of sprawling across the green landscape, we bring the green landscape into the city.
Well, and we can do more resource sharing that way. And as pagans, resource sharing ought to be pretty high on our list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I have talked about arcologies in the past, and I'm just thinking that if Paolo Salieri had been able to start over in a neighborhood like Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
He probably would have gotten a lot further with his project than if he did what he did, which is starting from scratch.
Starting from scratch in a corner of the Arizona desert. The Solari's problem is ultimately is that he was a student of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a great Wright fan,
mm-hmm.
not least because he was one of the few 20th century intellectual figures strongly influenced by the Druid revival. But
yeah, his home was Taliesin, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. He used the old Druid model of the truth against the world. He used the three rays of light symbol,
mm-hmm.
and all this kind of stuff. He was deeply into that whole thing,
mm-hmm.
but he had that. He was very much a participant in the cult of the architectural ego.
Right.
And I'm afraid Solari kind of absorbed too much of that.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of looking at, well, okay, let's build this gigantic tetrahedral object that towers over the landscape, let's take a neighborhood.
Right.
Let's take a neighborhood that is currently boarded up and, you know, left to the rats. I know enough pagans who keep pet ferrets. Rats should not be a problem. Okay, you know, there are several, this is called biological remediation, right? And so, you know, but let's look at that. Let's take a block.
Yeah.
I'm remembering John Crowley's novel, Little Big.
Oh, yes, beautiful book.
Yes, Old Law Farm,
mm-hmm.
in the middle of New York City.
Yeah.
George Mouse, one of the characters, had basically purchased an entire city block, and the entire interior of the block had become a farm,
mm-hmm.
with the rows of row houses around it forming almost like castle walls. That's totally doable.
There are co-housing collectives in places like Philadelphia that have done that. They
mm-hmm.
bought an entire city block, opened up the inside as shared green space.
Mm-hmm.
They share resources. You know, this house has the copy machine.
Yeah.
These few houses have the washer dryers.
Mm-hmm.
And the children all have a safe place to play.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fantastic.
This is what we need to do. The frontier now is inside the city.
Yeah.
And I think we need to start thinking. Basically, somebody's going to move into that space. If the pagan community has the gumption and the will and the smarts to kind of put itself at the head of the wave of the future, it could go amazing places.
Mm-hmm.
If it continues to cling to a kind of romantic attitude of sort of the pagan suburban or exurban ethos, I'm afraid it's going to be the theosophy of the 20th century.
That's intriguing.
I mean, every spiritual movement
yeah.
has a choice. Is it going to move with the times, or is it going to sort of
become moribund?
Become moribund, cling to its original culturally mandated image, and go under.
So this circles us back to our earlier discussion about theology,
mm-hmm.
where if our theology truly is that matter is not fallen, that the earth is a sacred place, and that the manifest world is where we do our magic, then it seems like the mandate you're laying out for us is a logical conclusion.
It's certainly one logical conclusion. I would hate to see any one conclusion become the answer. There's a concept called dissensus that I've come to find rather appealing, actually. The notion is that forcing a consensus is not necessarily a good thing. The disagreement leads to diversity, and we know from ecology that diversity is a good thing, and that includes diversity of ideas.
Right.
So that, I mean, for all I know, I could be wrong, and the future lies with, you know, little pagan communes out, you know, in rural Tennessee or something like that. But
he says with derision.
No. Actually, the thing is, I know some pagans out in rural Tennessee, and they seem to be doing some very interesting things. But at the same time, I want to see, as in any evolutionary situation, you never know when the lightning's going to strike. You never know which door is going to lead on to new possibilities and which one is going to turn into a blind alley. We need to explore as many of them as possible.
Well, and you're bringing up an interesting point, because my vision is that we have vital urban centers and then rural retreats. And so we're not all living at the retreat. There are caretakers for the retreat. And so when we need to get out in more green, there are places to go.
I would also look, what's the middle term? This is a bad habit among Druids. Anytime somebody offers a binary relationship, where's the third one?
Well, there's Pythagorean harmonics.
Well, Druids always think in threes. We always do triads. And so since our culture is so obsessed with these binary divisions, rural-urban, okay, one differentiation I'd point out is that the rural is not the opposite of the urban, but the midpoint between the urban and the wilderness.
Oh, I agree.
Okay, so we have...
But I don't want people living in the wilderness.
No, the wilderness should be a place where you can go under certain conditions in certain ways, leaving absolutely no trace.
Yes.
But you also have... So you have that rural intermediary, and you also have... You have the place in the mountain. You have the mountains that you can climb into.
Right.
To seek a vision.
Right.
So and everything in between, you know, big cities and small cities, rural, you know, isolated rural communes and farm towns, and everything in between. Continua rather than divisions.
The other vision I keep having in my head as we're talking about this conversation about Earth and cities in particular is the images that have been coming out of certain parts of Detroit that are literally being overtaken again by the green, not through human intervention.
No.
You know, the plants and trees are just pulling the buildings down and bursting forth through the concrete. And the earth is so powerful, you know, that it's not taking long at all.
We have this fantasy in our culture of big, raw-boned, strapping, masculine, well-hung humanity, you know, stomping ruthlessly over poor, helpless nature. What we're stomping on is the tail of a grizzly bear who can tear us to shreds.
Right.
Okay, the earth is older than we are, she is stronger than we are, she is sneakier than we are. And this is a planet that has shrugged off asteroid impacts and laughs at ice ages. Okay? I'm not worried about the survival of the planet. I'm concerned about the survival of our species, and I've pretty much written off the survival of industrial civilization. I mean, there are things we could have done, but I think we've probably wasted the opportunities we had, and now it's a question of what can we salvage.
Well, the other thing about your grizzly bear analogy is that just because something is capable of sustaining a lot of abuse doesn't mean we should continue to dish it out. You know, just because something is resilient doesn't mean you should keep punching it in the face.
Yeah.
And our care for the earth and our consciousness around it, thank the gods, is increasing and needs to become more and more integrated and incorporated into our daily lives, because our spiritual practice is not a compartmentalized thing.
No.
It is our lives.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. The problem, I think, is that our culture is permeated with the will to power.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think we can get away with punching someone in the face, we will. And the problem is that we're making a really big mistake in thinking that we can keep on punching this one in the face.
Hmm. Well, hopefully, as part of our theological maturation, we will see that that isn't actually strength or power, that that's just force, and that force is always weak.
But it's actually it's historical weakness. And yeah. I mean historical in a psychological sense. It's the enraged two-year-old
right.
throwing a temper tantrum and pounding his hands and feet on the floor.
Right.
There's no power. There's no real power in that. But, you know, it's what, you know, when the ego thinks it has no limits on it, it tends to revert to that sort of juvenile thinking.
Yeah. So we've gotten sort of into morose territory,
mm-hmm.
which is all right. I'm all for discussion of all sorts of things, but I'm wondering, as a druid
mm-hmm.
and a practitioner of that pathway, what are some of your favorite or most potent ways that you spiritually connect with Earth?
Meditation
mm-hmm.
is central to my own spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
And also simply spending time out in the natural world. That could be as simple a thing as going out in the backyard and laying down with your face to the grass.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole jungle world out there full of living things.
Mm-hmm.
I like to learn about nature,
mm-hmm.
by which I don't necessarily mean strictly books. In fact, you know, books can put a distance between you. I know all six of the native bees
mm-hmm.
Species
mm-hmm.
that pollinate my garden.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come out and what they do. And weirdly, the more I know about them, the less aggressive. I mean, none of them are particularly aggressive types, but at this point, even the paper wasps are friendly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, oh, hi there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no problem with the paper wasps. They eat the grubs that mm-hmm. would otherwise be taking out my tomatoes. Knowledge, meditation, ritual,
mm-hmm.
all the usual, you know, the usual tools.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, this isn't rocket science.
Mm-hmm.
This is simple stuff. It's available to everyone. More and more people are beginning to pick it up, if only because the failure of the other options is becoming so clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it not only does it not work to ignore nature and pretend that it's just a kind of cash machine where we can keep on making withdrawals forever and never make a deposit, but pretty soon it stops being fun.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people are beginning to wake up to the fact that we are in relationship here.
Mm-hmm. That was just the word I was going to
mm-hmm.
use. Yeah.
Yeah. That the earth is not a source for our greed and dumping ground for our wastes, but that in which we live and move and have our being. It is the collective of entities with which we are constantly in relationship.
Right.
And the more we work at building that relationship, the more positive a relationship it becomes for everybody.
Yeah, we're inextricably connected.
Yeah.
And it's intriguing that when I talk about nature, one of the first things you mentioned was meditation. Of course,
mm-hmm.
I meditate every day as well. And the thing I always tell my students is, first, we have to be in relationship within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then that relationship flows out and helps create and establish and facilitate relationship with everything else, which leads me to think that's probably why the paper wasps are more friendly, because
mm-hmm.
they feel that relationship with you now.
Well, one of the things that Philip Cargom, the contemporary Druid teacher, says is that nature isn't just outside us.
Mm-hmm.
We all contain nature.
Right.
Our bodies are nature. Our subconscious, our unconscious minds are nature. The part of us that we think of as being not natural, which is actually an outgrowth of nature, our conscious mind, our conscious awareness, is a very small part of us.
Right.
And the first thing we need to do is get that.
I agree.
Back into touch with our own nature. Human nature is nature.
That's right.
And then as we do that, we start flowing with the broader pattern. And the paper wasps kind of wave high on their way by to take out another grub off the tomato plant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. That's a beautiful way to end this discussion of Earth. So speaking of nature, I'd like to invite all my listeners to take a deep breath. Remember that every time you breathe in, you're breathing in the power of life, and every time you exhale, you're connecting with everything that lives. Holy Mother, in whom we live, move, and have our being, from you all things emerge, and unto you all things return. Thank you, John Michael Greer, for coming in. And once again, you can look at some of his work at the Ancient Order of Druids in America, aoda.org, or the archdruidreport.blogspot.com. I'm T. Thorne Coyle, thorncoyle.com, and may you be blessed.
Rock solid, oh, you lovers.